Welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to part two of a three-part program featuring the life and thoughts of 63-year-old Chris Lammercroft. If you missed part one, let me recap. Born in 1944, Chris moved with his family as a young boy to Fremantle, West Australia. At that time, Fremantle was largely untouched, and Chris learned to appreciate the natural splendour of that largely untouched land and coastline. He developed a passion for boating and ecology, which, along with his love of restoring old cars, gave him little time for anything else. This week, we learn how he met his wife-to-be, Hilary. We hear of his adventures in Thailand and the Philippines, trying to sell farm equipment and avoid rebels. However, it's towards the end of today's program that his green credentials shine and his concern for what is happening to both our local and world ecology comes through strongly. Now, we pick up with Chris finishing off his boating stories.
Do you ever find yourself in any dangerous situations?
We used not to think so. I guess when I was even younger in Cannanook Creek, closer to home in Carrum, we used to have a belly tank off an aircraft, and which was basically, if you can imagine, an eggshell cut in half longitudinally, and it had a big hole in the centre, presumably where the filler used to be, or the outlet. And we used to cart this thing down to the Cannanook Creek and shove a rolling pin in it, wrapped with cloth so that the water wouldn't come in. And this was about as stable as you can imagine.
Yeah,
and then you
right.
put this small boy in there. It couldn't swim. And it didn't have no, the belly tank had no buoyancy at all. So if it sank, you're a bloody history. All the rolling pin with the cloth popped out. Yeah, you would have a geezer there, but for only as long as it took to sink it, which would have been the end of me as well. But mucking around the boats like Ratty and Mole.
Yes. Yep.
I guess has been one of my, interests, but I guess the water and especially old boats have always interested me. But I'm still not the world's best swimmer. But I've done a lot of yachting.
Mm.
But I religiously wear a life jacket. But cars have in later years have taken over for me.
Now you mentioned getting married. What's your wife's name?
Wife at the time.
At the time.
Yeah, that was Hilary.
Hilary. Now, for a man who's working at IBM, got a passion, an overwhelming passion for cars and still boating, how in heaven's name did you find time for women?
Well,
how did you meet?
Bit of a late starter, I guess. My family home we had from about 1959 or 60 in Kalara and North Shore was on a corner and had two double garages in it, which with my cars and a very long suffering day when I look back. I'm not sure I would have been that suffering. I managed to fill them all up with old cars, but I ended up not only with those, I had them stashed all around Sydney.
Oh goodness.
And I had a number of Studebakers with really interesting bodies on them, stacked in people's yard. So a guy who used to be, I forget his correct title for the New South Wales Parliament, but it was like the Sergeant at Arms. I think he might have been Sergeant at Arms. His parents were blessed with a big block of land near Kalara Golf Club, so I had a couple of cars down there. And I used to wake up in a cold sweat thinking, where in the hell all these cars? So I didn't have time for women. And on this double garages, getting back to those, they were bifold ones, and they were, one of the garages had a boat built in it, so it was fairly tall. And these bifold doors, I used to swing them open and fold them back. And I'd written on the inside, wanted nice girls, which I subsequently changed to any girls. And the house came up for sale a couple of years ago in Kalara, and it's still got on the inside of the door.
Goodness.
Yeah, there's a sign there.
Message.
And my mate sent me a digital photo of it to say, it still exists, Chris. That doesn't answer your original question, but anyway, I was at a party between girlfriends. I managed to find a girlfriend by that stage. I mean, I had girls, but I probably didn't really know the art of romance in that case. I had a brilliant sister who I'm very good buddies with, and I've always been. And so I used to watch the goings on there. And but my wife was from the UK, and she was Welsh. And poor girl met me at a party, and we liked each other. And I got moved to, by the stage, I was working for an agricultural machinery company, and I got moved to Townsville. And she came up there with me, and the cars. And
of course.
Yeah, of course. And so we lived up there for a while, and then we got a posting to live in Malaysia. So aged about 35, 36, and so we moved over there where we had our first son. And so, and parted after a second son, probably about 10 years ago now.
Well, people do grow apart.
Oh, yeah, that was for all the wrong reasons, didn't I? Well. And I wasn't exactly blameless. But it's, but you know, I guess it takes two to tango in some areas, but I certainly wouldn't choose the moral ground on that particular one. Let's still very, very good friends with her, and I like her dearly, but yeah, as you said, things happen.
And life moves on.
Yeah, yeah.
But can we just come back to this? Going to Malaysia, that was your first trip overseas?
No, I'd been working for, the company was a fabulous Australian machinery company, the inventors of the rotary hoe for tillage. And they had a operation in, well, they didn't have an operation in Malaysia, they had a distributor there in KL. And so we as an Australian company, had bought them out, and I went over there to manage that. But I'd been going over to Southeast Asia for a couple of years prior to that, demonstrating the product and selling through the distributors. And but it was a fabulous entree into the world, I guess, because being agricultural machinery, you don't sell it in the city.
No, that's right.
So, you know, I'd be up in the Golden Triangle with police escorts, and I'd be, you know, in the middle of, you know, the boondocks in Thailand, and then, or anywhere else, and anywhere from Aceh province in Indonesia right down through to, basically, to Bali.
Well, in those last 30 seconds, you named four or five places, all of which are these days fairly notorious in terms of being hotspots, like the Golden Triangle and Aceh. Did you ever find yourself either being put or putting yourself into a situation where it was a little bit dicey?
In those days, a lot of it was dicey. And I've listened to my son's got a very prominent war correspondent. Well, he's a war photographer, goes to Iraq at the moment. And I hear back from my son about him, and I think, and how you have some inbuilt defences which you can't be totally cavalier. I guess a lot of people would say you are, but up to a point. But the Golden Triangle area, and this was the end of the Vietnam War, and you learnt, I was in the CMF, and we had a cell job done on us by the Australian government about the domino theory and how the Reds were going to move south and take over Australia. And then you get over there, and then you could ask some searching questions to the locals, in this case Thai nationals, and the director of Anglo-Thai. My wife and I developed a very good friendship with him. He was a resistance fighter when the Japanese were there, and he was also went to with all the major, with all the, I was going to say major generals, but not major generals, but anyway, all the hierarchy of Thailand, and through that contact with the king. I went most of the time with him, and he was not only well connected, but pretty savvy, as you can imagine, if he was a resistance fighter.
Mm.
Of the chess world in a show. culinary venue, it's Iceland, or the Philippines, or Hastings, or this place.
One night in Bangkok, in the world's your oyster. The bars are temples, but the pulse ain't free. You'll find a god in every golden oyster. And if you're lucky, then the god's a she. I can feel an angel sliding up to me.
One town's very like another when your head's down over your pieces, brother.
It's a drag, it's a bore, it's really such a pity to be looking at the bar, not looking at the city.
What do you mean? You've seen one crowded, polluted, thinking town.
Take a dance, warm and sweet.
Warm, sweet.
Somerset up, bring the Somerset on sweet.
Get tired, you're talking to a tourist whose every move's among the purest. I get my kids above the waistline, sunshine.
One night in Bangkok makes a heart man humble. Not much between despair and ecstasy. One night in Bangkok and the tough guys tumble. Can't be too careful with your company. I can feel the devil walking next to me.
Watching the game, controlling it. I don't see you guys rating the kind of mate I'm contemplating. I'd let you watch, I would invite you, but the queens we use would not excite you. So you better go back to your bars, your temples, your massage parlors.
One night in Bangkok, in the world's your oyster. The bars are temples, but the pulls ain't free.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices, featuring the life and times of older Australians.
So, but you know, some of the areas were uncomfortable, knowing that it's a bit like, and I feel for the guys in the Vietnam War, is the fact that, you know, how do you judge somebody who's wanted to do you in because they're just part of the crowd?
Yes.
And, the worst would have been in the Philippines, where you go to get on your aircraft and there'd be a deployment of troops sent out ahead of you to secure the perimeter of the airfield. But because you're in by that stage you'd be back at an airfield, which was pretty civilized. But you know, I used to have a little Ford, a bit like rolled out sheets of straight iron, made by the Ford company, called a Harimau, if I remember correctly. Had an escort motor in it, and it was like a pickup truck, with not much refinement, a bit like a mini moke, but much bigger. And I can remember being in provinces in the islands of Indonesia, of the Philippines, where I felt distinctly uncomfortable. Mm. And we bogged this thing one night, and we had tractor wheel weights in it. And apart from anything else, they're bloody heavy to get off the truck. And so we had to get the thing, take the wheel weights out, I think the three of us, and get this bloody thing out of the thing. And of course, we knew our voices would carry. And the headlights were on, and yes, we were stationary. And we knew that was probably the most threatening, but without any obvious threat.
Yes.
And you look back, and I wouldn't want to be fronting the Moro rebels today, no more than I did want to then, but mostly, if you use your sense, you're not totally disregarding it, but you are cautious, I guess.
So it sounds as though you've travelled fairly extensively through Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Which country had the most impact upon you?
Which country had the most impact on me? I like them all. And that sounds like it's avoiding the question, and somebody listening will probably say, well, you must find one better than the other. But no, I really don't. Mm-hmm. I like, the Indonesian people and the Malaysians, Thais. Thais are the most bloody brilliant engineers. I'm probably going to answer this a different way. Mm. Selling machinery and knowing my interest in vehicles, you go to these engineering shops and they pull the diff out of a vehicle, doesn't matter what it was, and they turn it into one of these little paddy tractors, with a couple of wheels on it. Okay. and a bar across the back which you put tines on and you drove in there, but also became the family truck.
Right.
And they build these things out of, and the kids would be 10, 11 years old while using the welders. And then you go on to something more sophisticated, and I've got a couple of Isuzu trucks now. But they buy these long-snouted 7-ton Isuzus, put a lazy axle on it. So if I remember correctly, that was theoretically CBC, a 7-ton truck. The lazy axle ran up to 11, if I remember correctly, but with still the only single diff. Then they put a teak body on it. So you're probably almost overweight by that stage. Then they go back, and I used to have bets started when I go to a sugar mill, bet what how many tons were coming over. And I've literally seen these 7-ton Isuzus with lazy axles coming. Now, if you can get the picture, they're in a cane field, which is not the smoothest place in the world. And so you've got the cane rows you've got to come over. So you can imagine the poor diff in the gearbox. So they come out onto the road, and then they go to the mill, which, however far that was, and they would come over the mill scales at 31 to 32 tons.
Oh, how did they ever move?
Well,
is a question.
Well, maybe another question was how did they ever stop? Because not all flat. And then they got the American war surplus trucks, which are old Kaisers and beautifully built, engineered to beyond belief. Except they had petrol engines in them. Well, tyres being tyres, fix that. They used to pull out the petrol engines and put out, put in general, GM or two-stroke diesels, which produce a hell of a lot of power with two firing strokes.
Yes.
Or they put in another diesel engine from something else. And so now they would come across, but they still only came over the weighbridge at 35 tonnes. And this was a truck capable of carrying 35 tons.
Mm.
But I had a tremendous amount of respect for Isuzu engineering, because it shouldn't have worked. And any engineer, including these Isuzu engineers, would probably say, no, you'll wreck it.
But
the tyres didn't know that, so I went out and did it.
So right.
Their ingenuity is in so many areas. I mean, it's not exactly yesterday's civilization. It's been around for a few eons.
Yes.
And they also got a great disrespect for authority, which goes down well with an Australian, and we go down well with them for the same reason. But I love their phrase was, Cham Nong's phrase was, the king is the king, and whatever the king says, everybody lines up and does. The government is the government, and the people are the people. And you've got to bridge that big gap, because the people don't want to do what the government wants them to do.
Right.
And sounds a bit like Australia. Although, after this APEC thing, we'll brutalise you to death so that we do what you want to do, we want you to do. So it gets onto a totally different subject. But the Thais have got a lot of, in my opinion, affinity with Australia, because they've got a wicked sense of humour, but yes. they don't want to toe the company line, so to speak.
Were you travelling on your own, or was your wife with you?
No, she was. Oh, occasionally she'd come to Bangkok with me, but most of the other time I'd be home for 2 weeks. It's the way to lead a married life, folks. Home for 2 weeks, away for 2 weeks. Right. Basically all year. And I've got a mate who's still in the business at the moment, and he's even worse than that. He's going to be out and out in Mongolia and in really impoverished circumstances. But that's what you've got to do when you're selling farm machinery. And it's not, certainly isn't good for domestic relations, as you can imagine.
No. Now, earlier, again, before we went on air, you were talking about some of the poorer impressions you had of Asia, particularly what's happening to the land over there. Do you want to sort of share that with us?
Yeah, well, for those listening, I was commenting that I probably have seen, you know, I don't think it'd be exaggeration to say 500,000 hectares of land cleared from jungle. And I met one of the surveyors, an English guy, up in north, you know, in Kedah State, anyway, near the Thai border in Malaysia. And he was saying how he used to climb the trees to get a reference to point to, so he could do his survey. And the tigers that he'd see in the jungle and, you know, the other wildlife. And when I was looking at it, was both a sugarcane plantation in Kedah and also the Muda rice irrigation scheme was, had been there for longer, but it would have had to been cleared the same, you know, this sugar plantation. And when you look at it, and then you're looking at it, it's only bloody sugar. I mean, you know, it's not as if it's, we can't live without it. And then you go to, you know, Seremban, there was another, nearby there was another rice sugar project, and they cleared it out. But Malaysia tended to, because I guess from different backgrounds, so tend to clear the land a little bit more sympathetically. But you go to places like Palembang, PT Palembang Rice Estates, you know, somebody will love me for making that comment, but it was in south of Sumatra, and it was a Japanese contract, if I recall correctly, and certainly mainly Japanese doing the driving of the bulldozers, but they'd clear right down through the creeks and up the other side, and they were at a, you know, for a rice plantation. Mm-hmm. And you think, for, you know, won't use the words on radio, but it's just, it's so totally pathetic that, and most of these soils are lateritic and washed like blazes, and there's the topsoil is 3/8 of sweet nothing to start off with, so you lose it immediately. And they put, and I think Palembang might have been also palm oil, and which, you know, you can start me on that one and how it fits into the world scheme too, but you know, we've lost all this biodiversity, you know, for, and not done it even well. And okay, we all know you got to clear a bit of land, but you know, to do it the way we've done it, and then you get onto the logging, and that includes South Gippsland, you know, those listening. You know, we go in there and everybody said, no, it's right. And then even at home, you know, the government department says, oh, we're logging at 5 times the sustainable rate. We don't have that. And you know, and the, so it's all easy to cast aspersions of, you know, somebody else. But we are in Australia here. Yes. And it's absolute. And then nobody loses their job in the government. You know, like you would in private enterprise. You made such a gigantic cock-up as that, you'd be out the door like a rocket. But in private enterprise, but nobody suffered the consequences of that. And this really worries me from a, it's this, it's short-term fix. And I watched the current debate about guns. It's a wide-ranging with my shots, but, and the same really applies to that. And I say, we'll lose our jobs. Excuse me, you know, let's say 20 years down the track, there will be no jobs from pulp mill because there would be no bloody trees the way we're going. And it would, and okay, they say we're going to put plantation trees in. Great. You're going to bulldoze our jungle down to put the plantation trees in. It just is a totally inane argument. And why people don't, people, I guess you're going to say, bureaucrats could say it up to a point, but the ministers have got to say it. It's those, and the environmental organisations, which of course they do, but say, just look on a macro scale of things. You don't think of the micro, like the Australian government have done for the last 20 years. You know, there's no long-term process. If you're working for a corporation, you expect to have at least a 5-year plan. A lot of corporations have a 10-year plan.
Yes, that's right.
Having worked for a Japanese major corporation, they certainly have a 10-year plan. If you spoke to a Chinese, they probably have a 100-year plan.
Yes.
But we don't. And this is this total inanity of what we think we're doing. And having said what I've watched in the Middle East, because I used to work over there in the desert, so the amount of gum trees being planted and rehabilitating the desert, they're going the other way, and successfully. But you look and you think, well, yeah, you've got all these this disparity, as I guess is what I'm really alluding to, of people taking on different attempts to either denude the planet, and when we moved, more recently, we moved from Dubbo, where I was working after I came back from Malaysia, to Melbourne. And I said to my wife, having been brought up in Sydney, this place is untouched, Melbourne, in 1980. At Williamstown, you could buy any number of places in Williamstown on the front for a reasonable price. Beaconsfield Parade, you could buy places really reasonably down there. And because our factory was at Thomastown, we used to come in from Whittlesea, and we'd come up in Crest Hill on the top of High Street or whatever the extension of that is, and you'd see Melbourne and the city, and I'd say to my wife, you should just go and buy this farm. Yeah, this is going to be worth a fortune. But you see the expansion of around Melbourne, and I'm talking since 1980, and there was Fountain Gate was the extremities going towards Warrigal, basically. And now, basically, to Warrigal, you can see it's gradually being built up. But you project that out in a grand scale of things, and we can't keep doing this to the planet.
But we keep trying.
Yeah, but you get aim our shots more specifically. You get the idiotic comments from, federal politicians saying, oh, we need more population. Excuse me?
Join me next week for the third and final part of Chris's story, where he continues to express his concern for both the environment in Australia and overseas, and has a few scathing things to say about politicians. I invite him to speak his mind, and he does. Join Chris and I next week on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.